Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. My name is Justin Landon, and I am joined by Nick Mamatas. Nick is the author of 8 novels, including the recently released The Last Weekend and Love is the Law. His fiction has been nominated for several awards, including the Bram Stoker, but tonight he's here in his capacity as an editor. Formerly of Clark's World, Nick is now an editor for Japanese science fiction imprint Haikusoru, an imprint of Viz Media. His newest project was released just last week, titled Phantasm Japan. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad we could get this set up. Before we talk a little bit about your current project, Phantasm Japan, I kind of wanted to go into Haikusoru a little bit. A lot of your books have done extremely well, but I'm not sure people realize how extensive the imprint is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of folks have heard about All You Need Is Kill after Edge of Tomorrow. But give us a little bit of a look at what Haikusoru is all about.
Well, we primarily do Japanese science fiction and translation in the U.S. We've been around since 2009. Actually, All You Need Is Kill by Hiroshi Sakurazaka was our first title. One of two we released back in July of 2009. 6 years later, it was the basis of the motion picture Edge of Tomorrow. Actually, a lot of people didn't know we've sold a very large number of copies of the book. We actually have our first mass market was the movie tie-in. The first mass market title we did. Our other famous books included Battle Royale, which was the basis for the very notorious 2000 film. We had our first anthology was The Future's Japanese, a science fiction anthology, in which Mono no Aware by Ken Liu was printed for the first time. It was the Hugo winner in 2012. And we've had a bunch of other very interesting books. We've even done some strange little tie-in books, including Miyuki Miyabi's tie-in for the cult of video game Ico, Castle in the Mist, which is one of the rare video games that people consider a work of art. And we have the tie-in novel for that. And we've done all sorts of other crazy things, a lot of hard science fiction, a smattering of fantasy, some classics, including 10 Billion Days and 100 Billion Nights by Ryu Mitsuse, which was sort of like the Dune or like the 2001 of Japanese science fiction?
Yeah, no, I have read 2 of your novels. I read All You Need Is Kill, and I've actually read 10 Billion Days and 100 Billion Nights. And those books really couldn't be any different.
That's true.
Kind of gets to one of the questions that I have, which is we hear a lot of people talk about phrases like Chinese science fiction or Caribbean science fiction or Japanese science fiction, and it's obvious as you start to read more and more, there really isn't anything that's a catch-all that we talk about. You know, we say we're going to bring in more Japanese science fiction as though that actually means something other than fiction written by people who are from Japan.
Correct.
But we love to categorize things like that. And as I read those 2 books, like I really couldn't come up with anything that sort of unified them, obviously, other than that fact they're written by somebody from Japan. I mean, how do you deal with that idea?
It's a challenge. I mean, honestly, I have a lot of people come up to me saying, that they've read 1 or 2 of their books, and now they feel that they finished Japanese science fiction because they've read a book. Now, and I've exposed myself to Japanese SF. I can go back to reading whatever they like to read instead. But Japanese SF is huge. I mean, one, it's there's a very busy publishing industry in Japan. So there's a lot of stuff and a lot of different subgenres, just like here in the United States. There are some differences. I would say there's more hard SF there, much less fantasy in the epic or heroic mode. That is, you know, sort of looking at a medieval culture and having some sort of epic to throw something into a volcano or to save something from a volcano. A lot less of that. Many more sort of teen girl heroes, shorter novels, weirder novels, relatively few books with human-like aliens. Probably because of the hard SF. You know, if you're really talking about hard SF, you're not going to have sort of rubber foreheaded Star Trek style aliens. So there are differences, and of course it's heavily influenced by Western SF. You know, people still love Clark and Asimov and Heinlein in Japan, just like in the US, and it influences everyone. But it is a challenge to get people to read more than one Japanese science fiction novel at a time. That's for sure.
Yeah, I imagine that's true. One of the things that I observe, though, about the imprint's books is that you do seem to make quite a bit of an effort to retain a feel to the book, both with the cover art and sort of mm-hmm. the styling of the book, that retains a very Japanese feel. I presume that's pretty intentional.
Well, when we started, we one issue is this, right? Since all this work is in translation, it's like having an imprint full of first novels.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so there's no famous person really anchoring or the field or giving us a tentpole until now, obviously, with OED to Skill. So we had to make the books look similar to one another to have them stand out on the shelves. So they're like different from Western SF to a certain extent, and they look very similar to one another with a choice of font. And for a while, we were putting all the spine information, reading sort of reverse of the usual, just to have the people, because that's what they do in Japan, and just make it stand out on the shelf. And we were doing all sorts of things to try to build up a brand. So we would know a Haikatsuro book was a Haikatsuro book. In the same way, you know, a Bane book is a Bane book to a certain extent, or like a Nightshade book tended to all look alike, while the Nightshade books tended to have a sort of a house look. We've since moved on from that since it's been a few years now. We've done some hardcovers. But we do try to keep things very Japanese. We don't want to do a lot of cultural translation. You know, when I was a kid, a lot of manga and anime sort of coming out in the U.S., and a lot of it was really butchered. Miyazaki's movie, Nausicaa on the Valley of the Wind, was totally butchered and, you know, rewritten for its first American release. You might remember the cartoon Battle of the Planets, which had a whole new character built in, that little robot that was living under the sea. He was sort of like a C-3PO slash R2-D2-like character. He was introduced just for the American audiences. And one of the characters, who was called Kiop in this version, you know, spoke in that kind of a computer-esque gibberish, like, woo, 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 that kind of thing. And in the Japanese original, he had plenty of dialogue. Now, people who work in localization and translation of Japanese popular culture are very eager not to do that sort of thing. And we're very eager to create an original experience. Having said that, we do make some changes. For example, Ori no Kill was a light novel in Japan, which means that it had illustrations. But we removed the illustrations because it looked too much like a manga. And we don't want to be confused with manga. We don't want the kids who love manga to open up our books and say, hey, wait a minute. This is like homework. You know, there's reading involved in this one. Right. So we had to make sure they were novels too. So it was a tough road to travel.
We talked a little bit about The Edge of Tomorrow earlier, and I just wonder, from your perspective, having published All You Need Is Kill, and The Edge of Tomorrow actually got pretty good reviews.
Yeah, it got excellent reviews.
As a film on its own, without any sort of concept of the novel. And I assume you've seen the film.
Oh, yeah.
How did you think it held up?
I liked the movie. I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was pretty funny. Again, it's a novel, a movie about the world being torn to shreds by aliens, and it was pretty funny. So that's the kind of thing I like. And I thought it was a pretty good version of the film, of the book, with many, many differences. Of course, the main one being no Japanese people, which is a problem, definitely. But I'll tell you that Sakura Zaka, the author of the novel, really enjoyed the film organically. You know, he wasn't just saying that when I spoke to him last week, you know, for the sake of the press. He was, you know, very eager to see the film, and he really enjoyed it. It certainly raised his profile here in the West. You know, I had somebody else, I had Warner Brothers, basically buy billboards and put in every train station in the country about this book. On some level, sure, absolutely. You know, things have been changed, things have been whitewashed. On another level, despite that whitewashing, the book became so much more popular than it could have ever possibly have dreamed of becoming, thanks to the film.
Does he have other work that you're trying to bring over?
We have a second novel by him called Slum Online, which is more of a mainstream novel. It's about a kid who loves playing online video games, like an online fighting game. And it's basically like a coming-of-age story where he conquers the game and also sort of conquers his love life and conquers college. And it's actually really interesting. You know, that would have been a good movie as well. It could have been like a YA, realistic YA type of movie with this video game as sort of the emotional analog to what's actually going on in the real world. And he's not a fast writer. He is working on a sequel. He's also working on a short story for another editor that we're hoping he can get done in time, that it might be an anthology here in the United States next year. So yeah, we're hoping that we can get more out of him, and we're hoping that, and people have to a certain extent, who love Ori no Kill are finding Slum Online, which is one of my favorite books that we put out.
If he writes a sequel, will it be published simultaneously in Japan and the United States?
Probably pretty closely. Pretty closely. I mean, to a certain extent, in Japan, they can publish things right away. So if you were to hand in a manuscript, let's say on January 1, and it gets copied by January 15, they could have it out by March 1. Just things are, just distribution works differently over there. It's more like books are treated almost like magazines on that level. Hmm. And some books are, you know, like we put out a book a few years ago called Marduk Scramble, which was a huge, huge novel, 900 pages. In Japan, it was three volumes. And the volumes came out 1 month after another. So there's no long wait, the way you have to wait like 6 months or a year here in the U.S. So we had to put it out in one gigantic volume, but they could put it out in three small volumes. So just things work differently there on a distribution level. But it would be pretty close.
But you have done a graphic novel version of All You Need Is Kill as well, right?
That's right. We had a graphic novel version. So the graphic novel was sort of an attempt to demonstrate what we would have thought the film could have been like, had it been more like the original novel. At the same time, a Japanese manga was released, so we brought the manga over. And the manga was by a very popular mangaka, Obata, and had many more pages. So the graphic novel wasn't necessarily a huge success because the manga really attracted most of the attention. But we like the graphic novel, and we may do some more interesting things like in the future. I mean, that was one of many things we've been doing to get away from just doing translations. So we did this anthology. We did another anthology. We're doing a third anthology coming out. We did a Catherine Valente collection. So we're experimenting with doing more than just bringing novels over and translating them from the Japanese down.
Well, and that seems to be at least slightly informed by the fact that you've been recently approved as a CIFWA market.
That is, we did the anthologies first, then we got approved.
Right. Well, yeah. I guess what I'm saying is now that you're doing more work with people that care about the fact that you're a CIFWA qualified market. So I guess that is a direction that you guys will be heading more.
We'll see what happens. If people buy the book, if people buy Fantastic Japan, we'll put out plenty more mixed anthologies of Western and or non-Japanese and Japanese authors. Sure.
Before we jump into Phantasm Japan, I did want to talk a little bit about the nature of translation. Mm-hmm. And Haikusoro is kind of, in a lot of ways, in science fiction and fantasy, kind of led the charge on this. But now we're starting to see some other presses take notice and start to do a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. Tor, obviously, is coming out with a three-body problem a little bit later this year from Lu Shixian, and mm-hmm. We're seeing they've also done some German translation, and they're bringing out Thomas Older Hoyfeldt's novel coming out here not too far, and Neil Clark has recently launched a Kickstarter for Chinese SF translation. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about why we're seeing a greater interest in bringing things from other markets?
Honestly, my guess is that it's probably because of not of Haikusuru or not of anything in SF, not the long tradition of Stanislaw Lem coming over, or the Stigarsky brothers who have been around, you know, translated for a while. I think it's because of crime fiction. And I think a few years ago, the number one book in the country was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which made $1 zillion from being a work of translation. And I think now that publishing is more of an international business with you know, one company being owned by a German conglomerate, another one being a French conglomerate, one being, you know, an Australian conglomerate, essentially, others that are American conglomerates that have, you know, offices all over the world. Finding a world property is of great interest. Not that, you know, Clark's World and Neil Clark, who are not a part of a conglomerate, aren't doing it for the love of science fiction or the love of wanting to connect with new writers you couldn't find otherwise. But I think in the broad strokes publishing industry, everyone's looking for the next world property.
I have to wonder.
So that's not an exciting answer. Sorry to disillusion you.
No, I think it's probably true, although, you know, given these large conglomerates, they're also only going to try to do this if they think it's going to sell. And I have to wonder if there's some sort of desire within the marketplace to see things that are, you know, a constant desire to find something that's new, especially in science fiction and fantasy, where we tend to recycle
ideas a lot. But we want new things too. We want new variations. We want, and the best way to get a new variation is to go far afield.
Right.
So there's that tension. I mean, there's a science fiction, especially, is neophilic, right? People want the new thing, but they also want to be reminded of the science fiction they read as a child that made them want to read science fiction forever. So that's the great difficulty. I mean, a lot of Japanese SF reminds people of the science fiction they read as kids. When All You Need Is Kill came out, I remember getting a couple of letters from people saying, yes, this is going to be the one. This is it. This reminds me of reading Heinlein or reading Joe Haldeman for the first time.
Yeah, I actually find it to be quite a bit like Armor from John Stakely. It's kind of the book that it most reminds me of.
Mm-hmm.
Although, when was All You Need Is Kill originally written?
Oh, it's pretty, it's not so long ago. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it was in the 2000s. I mean, Sakura's
Oh, really? It's that recent.
It's pretty recent.
So, as the editor of an imprint that's 90% or 95% translation, as an editor, how do you manage that environment? What role do you fill between the translator and the author, and how are you buying manuscripts from Japan? Do you read Japanese?
Not a word. The editor-in-chief of Haikusudo is my supervisor, Masumi Washington, who also co-edits the anthologies. What she does is she commissions sort of very brief machine translations of certain chapters of certain books and gets summaries of them, and we talk about them, and I read them, and together we choose which ones we're going to do from that. So, which is not all that different than publishing in New York. I mean, outside of first novels, a novel has been purchased based on a summary from an established author. In my other life, I just sold a novel without writing a word of it yet, for the first time.
Sure.
So it certainly happens. As an editor, it's a little different than other editors. In some ways, it's easier. Some ways, it's harder. It's a lot easier in that I don't have to deal with agents and the authors themselves for the most part, and I can just have the text. That can also make it very difficult. I can't go back to an author and say, you know what, we need to cut 20,000 words, or we need to change the ending, because it's already been published. So it's in some levels like working in a reprint house, and I'm a content coordinator. The main creative part of the job is that most translators, whether it's from Japanese or any other language, are not really novelists. They don't have the ear of the novelist. And certainly in Japan, where in the Japanese field, rather, where many people got their start translating video games or manga, which may have 10,000 words in it if you're lucky, or even, business stuff like, contracts and stereo instructions or whatnot, they certainly don't have the ear of a novelist. So a lot of my job involves massaging the translation to make it more novelistic, to make it more entertaining a read.
Obviously, when a United States writer, an American writer, is trying to sell foreign rights, oftentimes they have a foreign agent that's representing them and shopping that manuscript. That's not the case for you?
No, in Japan, there are very few agents. Some authors have agents, like Miyuki Miyabe, who's quite popular here in the U.S. too. She has two publishers. We publish a lot of her science fiction and fantasy. Another publisher does a lot of her mysteries and thrillers. So she's sort of well-known. She has an agent, but she's very popular in Japan. It's like a Nora Roberts figure. For the most part, in Japan, the publishers run the show. So we would approach a publisher who would be licensing to us. So last week, for example, Sakura Zaka came to the U.S. because he won a prize. He won the Japan Cool Award, and he came out to the U.S. with his editor from Shueisha, in the way that somebody might come with their agent, or might come with an attorney, or might come with a friend otherwise. And in Japan, short stories are a really big deal, and most of the little magazines, or many of them anyway, are run by book publishers. And the magazines are a way for them to find new talent. And even the awards are often, not always, but often run by the publishers, like of contests and of annual awards and that sort of thing. And that's how they develop new writers, via short fiction or novelette or novellas, and then they get a collection and they get a novel out. So it's really oriented around the publisher. So we spend a lot of time communicating with publishers as opposed to agents or even individual authors.
That's interesting. I suppose then there's not quite a bit of not quite a lot of movement of writers between publishers in Japan either. I imagine once you're in a house, you're there to stay.
Horrifyingly, no.
No.
No. Once you are published in Japan, you are at the disposal of everyone in Japan. So if, for example, let's say you're a science fiction author, and then some newspaper says we want you to write 500 words on the importance of Valentine's Day, you're going to do it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So once you're in, you're in. And of course, you can not be very popular and, not get a lot of gigs. But the expectation is that whoever comes knocking will get something from you, large or small, that sort of thing. So you can become very busy right away if you're a semi-successful Japanese author.
I could just see the demand for blog posts. All right. Phantasm Japan, which is your second collection, your first mm-hmm. collection, which was The Future is Turning Japanese.
The Future is Japanese. It already is Japanese.
The Future is Japanese. was out in 2012, and this is out just last week in September of 2014. And the title of the first anthology, to me, had this really sort of obviously coded as science fiction. Mm-hmm. Phantasm Japan seems to be a little more squishy in that regard. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about this anthology and kind of the imagining behind it?
Sure. Well, The Future is Japanese was a science fiction anthology. And of course, once you do science fiction, the next one you do is fantasy. So Phantasm Japan is our fantasy anthology. But of course, I'm one of those notorious people who sees the line between the two genres as extremely blurry and wide. So we have things that can certainly be easily read as science fiction. And in The Future of Japanese, we had things that could have easily been read or were outright fantasy. It comes from being a kid and, you know, getting these anthologies from Daw or whatever and about the space or something. There'd always be like one ghost story for no reason. And I sort of imprinted on that. But Phantasm Japan has it's about half Japanese, half non-Japanese writers. We have a mix of, you know, different people that we've enjoyed over the years. We have power writers like Gary Bronbeck and James A. Moore. We have sort of up-and-coming writers like Joseph Tamara, is probably his fourth or fifth piece. Quentin Crisp, a well-known in small circles, sort of a very quiet, dark fantasy British writer. We have Zachary Mason, a mainstream fantasist who wrote The Lost Books of the Odyssey. He wrote five short stories for us. Tim Pratt, my neighbor, here in Berkeley, California, gave me a story. And we have some great Japanese stories, too, from Project Ito, who we've published before. He won the Philip K. Dick Award runner-up prize for Harmony. And we have a great, great novella by him. We have Miyabi, who we talked about already. Seiya Tanabe, a great ghost story writer who's been to WorldCon. She's come to the U.S. several times. And it's a very fun, weird mix.
I was surprised that looking at both this anthology and the previous anthology that so many of the writers aren't Japanese. Why did you make that choice? It's an interesting choice when you're talking about writing about Japan and writing about sort of cultural references to Japan and commentary on those cultural references. And half of your writers aren't Japanese, and some of them may not be that familiar with Japan other than the story that they've researched and written. And so what was the decision-making behind that?
Well, in The Future's Japanese, I think almost all the Western writers had some connection with Japan, whether they lived there. Some, like Felicity Savage, you know, work there. She's a translator herself from English to Japanese. Catherine Valente lived there for several years. David Moles lived there for quite a while. With Phantasm, there are fewer Japanese connections, but there are certainly some. With many of the authors or authors who were of Asian descent or an Asian background who were familiar with Japan, not because of a sort of hemispheric proximity and interest in Japan. Plus, we have people who did a lot of research and who are, you know, professional academics. Lauren Natterell is getting her PhD. Alex Dolly McFarland's sort of an academic, so they can research really well. But as far as the writing concerned, basically a lot of the Japanese stories are longer. So we have a novella from Denpo Tadashima. We have a long piece from Project Ito. So while there are more authors that are non-Japanese on the level of the text, it's more than half Japanese. And this is just partially because Japanese stories tend to run longer. It's much easier to publish a novelette or a novella in Japan than it is here in the U.S. So to get the good pieces, they often tend to be on the long side.
The stories from Zachary Mason in the book are interesting.
Yeah.
They're all 2 pages or 3 pages, depending on your typeset. And they're all very, I don't know how else to, I would call them almost parables. I don't know if that's an accurate term, but that's what they seem like to me. And they all sort of deal with, to one degree or another, something that I find in a lot of Japanese fiction and is the shapeshifter.
Yeah.
And this is such a, it's a prevalent trope. It's as prevalent as the wizard in a tower in the West, it seems like.
Yeah.
And I was just curious, is your perspective, having edited so many things from Japan now, I mean, why is that such a prevalent trope?
Well, I think the shapeshifter is very prevalent in the United States, in the West as well, I should say, not just the U.S., but of course, there are many native traditions about shape-shifting people and characters. Trickster figures tend to shift shape depending on what they need to be doing. Also, there's a lot of religious syncretism, so you have to combine Shintoism, animism, Buddhism, and these combinations often lead to certain characters or certain archetypal character types having more than one role. And we can even see this in Greek myths. You know, look at the god Hermes. Hermes is a very busy god. You know, he's a messenger. He's a thief. He's a communicator. He occasionally does double duty to the underworld. And other Greek gods also have different roles and often take different shapes based on these roles. So I don't think it's necessarily only Asian or only Japanese or primarily Asian or Japanese that they have a lot of shape-shifting. What is interesting is that these tropes have kept their thematic power over the years, as opposed to having been superseded or replaced or facing competition for more modern ones, like, say, a wizard or a dragon or a wizard on a dragon. Or elves that look a lot like people and not like little beings who dance around your ankles, right? So what I think it might be missing, or what, well, not maybe not missing, but is not present, is sort of like a Tolkien-esque figure who can formalize a different precinct of fantasy and say, this is what fantasy really is. So we have more folkloric impulse toward fantasy inside Japan.
One of the other things that I noticed about a lot of the stories that I read in the anthology was that structurally, the stories, even the ones from American-born writers, are not typical story structures or voices that we see in a lot of the science fiction and fantasy magazines that publish in the United States. I don't think there are a lot of stories in this anthology, and I think this is in no way a criticism, in my opinion, that I wouldn't see published in, say, Lightspeed or some of the other magazines. They just seem to be unique structurally. How much of that is speaking to a Japanese motif?
I think it's just our taste. I mean, to a certain extent, the Japanese stories are, for the most part, reprints. That is, they've been original to the United States, original to English, but they were printed previously in Japan. So Masumi, who did the primary selections on those, had the choice of a couple thousand stories in the past 5, 6, 7 years. And chose the ones that were the most interesting, that were the most compelling, that are the most weird. And some of them are actually quite traditional, too. Like Miyabe's story is quite traditional. About a girl who got the job, dressing like a bunny in a costume shop. And when she puts the bunny hat on, she can see certain things in the passersby. Like that could be a Richard Matheson story or a Bob Sheckley story. But others are more unusual, that's to say the least. But I think it's just taste. To a certain extent, I also think that the rise of online magazines like Clark's World, like Lightspeed, and I might be to blame for this partially, have led to a new kind of writing that works best in a scroll. That is, it works best when you're scrolling on your telephone or scrolling down a screen, and that there are a lot of scene breaks, very few transition sentences, a lot of paragraph-sized bites of description followed by tiny bits of dialogue followed by more description. And if you're working primarily on the printed page, that kind of story doesn't really work as well. So I think that there's been a shift toward online fiction in the mainstream of fantasy and science fiction, and that the fiction we're publishing is more printed page fiction. That might be a controversial interpretation of what's going on.
That's a very interesting dichotomy you've created.
Yes.
I don't know that I've ever heard it described quite that way, but I think it has some merit. Certainly, if you look at the stories that have been recognized in the online magazines and if we're seeing the award ballots, they seem to be increasingly representative of online stories.
I keep telling people having a scene break in the story is a good thing, but it's like sounding a giant gong in the middle of say, dinner. You should have a strong reason to sound a gong. And the reason shouldn't be, well, I don't know how to get them from the airport to the house.
Well, I actually think the gong ringing is wonderful because that's usually when I need to pick up the phone at work and do something.
Sure, that's part of it too, right? You're reading online. You want to have a quick break and able to do something else. Tweet about the story. Complaint about the story, something like that. So maybe it's evolutionary in that way.
Now, you mentioned the Tim Pratt story earlier, and then you just talked about the story, which I believe is titled Chiyoko.
Mm-hmm. That's Miyabe's story. Yeah.
Yes. The Tim Pratt story is frightening and haunting in that it sort of plays on the fetishization of the Japanese woman in American mm-hmm. culture. I mean, it's a fantastic story. Given that it was original this anthology, and you've worked with Tim on it, and he's your neighbor. I'd just be curious to get your thoughts on that story.
Well, it's a strange reaction. Like, you find it frightening and scary and sort of dark. I just thought it was hilarious. For just to catch people up, it's basically about the sort of almost a cliche. Well, not almost cliche. A absolute cliche of what they call like a neck beard. Who's sort of like a heavy guy who has a, you know, scraggly beard and a fedora, and he's never really looking with girls, but he thinks he's hot, stuff, and he's got a katana, and he likes to wave it around, and he goes, okay, Cupid, and he meets a yokai. A yokai is like a Japanese monster. And from there it goes on. So I thought it was just a funny story, and Masumi thought it was a very funny story, so we just got a kick out of it. And of course it turns dark. It has a black humor to it, almost a gallows humor, you might say. But it was funny to hear you just find out, oh, this is a dark story about justification. And then just before, we had a review come out a couple days ago by this woman named Cicely Kane on the Skippy and Fanny show. And she had tweeted to Tim that this was one of the best feminist science fiction and fantasy stories she'd ever read. Which one is great. It's great to hear that people are so excited about the story. On the other hand, I kind of want to send Cicely Kane some like Tiptree stories or something.
Right. No, yeah. It's funny. It is funny. I mean, it's funny in a laugh with it. Because we all know this guy, right? Or we've all seen this guy. But by the same token,
he's probably doing the podcast right now. You're going to give us some comments.
Right. But it's also like this blatant predator, which is inherently frightening, especially in the online world where we interact with people every day.
Sure.
And you never quite know what's lurking behind the male gaze, if you will, I guess. to give Cicely Kane some credit there, lurking behind the male gaze. But it's interesting because that is a commentary from a Western writer about this weird cultural phenomenon that intersects with Japan. And I think that's what's interesting about this anthology, that I think a lot of people, when they hear, oh, this is a Japanese science fiction anthology, that it's just about Japan and it's just about fiction that comes out of Japan. But what I took away from the stories that I read, and I haven't read all of them yet, but the ones that I read, is that it very much is an intersection of the two cultures, which I think is significant.
I don't know, more than two, because we have a story that takes place in Hong Kong, you know, about a sort of post-apocalyptic Hong Kong, China, you know, and we have other things that take place, you know, in America, but Japanese things sort of emerge. We have things in the future. We have a story where Japan never existed, or maybe it was only a dream. The remit we gave to authors was, for the Western side or the non-Japanese side authors, was write with a Japanese theme. And that can mean a Japanese character, can mean a Japanese mythical construct, a Japanese cultural idea. You know, sort of controversially, actually, the future is Japanese, opened with Japan being destroyed, only one Japanese person being left in the universe, which is sort of the opposite of it being the future is Japanese, right? You know, so we were pretty open. So we didn't want people just to write about Japan. The one rule we had was you can't write a story where some guy's watching anime and the anime becomes real, because that's everybody's first impulse.
That's good advice, Nick. That is demonstrating your editorial prowess right there.
That's right.
All right. So you have another anthology coming out next year or the year after?
Next year, yeah. Can I talk about it yet? I don't know if I can. I guess I will say in broad strokes it's going to be a crime anthology with science fictional and fantastical elements. And that doesn't mean write me a note saying, hey, can I submit to your anthology? I don't want that. I don't want any letters from people saying, well, I'll be great at this.
Well, I don't believe you have any submission guidelines on your website. So
that's right. We have no submission guidelines, which is funny because people keep asking for them now that we're in a CIFWA market. And I keep thinking, does Random House have submission guidelines on their website? Are people bugging Random House about the submission guidelines? Yeah, no.
Just remember, if you're sending Nick something, he prefers things in 8-point font, you know, PDF only. The good
stuff. Just embedded in a cake. That's what I like. Just mail me cake with your story on top.
All right. Well, this has been a bit of an education on Japanese publishing, in addition to American publishing of Japanese fiction. And Phantasm Japan is out in all stores now, I presume.
That's right. Yep.
The stories that I have read, I've enjoyed very much, and I will say that it's definitely a bit of an education in fiction, because it is very lots of unique stories, and it's interesting to hear you say that that's your taste, and Masumi's taste, rather than just a reflection of Japanese science fiction. I wonder, I have a feeling a lot of people will read it and say, oh, well, this is just as Japanese science fiction, not Nick and Masumi's tastes.
In fact, one of the contributors put up a blog post saying, oh, Japanese fiction seems so innovative. And on some level, yeah, there's innovation the same way there's innovation here. But of course, when you choose from a pool of 4,000 stories over the past 10 years, you can choose the most innovative ones very easily. Well, I can only ask like 20, 30 authors and again choose 10 stories from my submissions.
Hopefully people check it out. And I appreciate you being here, Nick.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
All right. This has been Rocket Talk.